60% of the US population will experience some type of gastroesophageal reflux disease, or GERD, every year, with 20 to 30% having symptoms every week. Hospitalizations more than doubled over the last decade. Half of those with GERD symptoms have more heartburn at night than during the day. Two-thirds report difficulty sleeping, and 40% report that daily functioning is compromised the following day. What can you do to stop this burning, painful illness? Well, stay tuned. We're going to give you ideas and solutions today. Go Healthy for Good starts right now. Welcome to Go Healthy for Good. I'm Dr. Nerida and I'm pleased you've joined me today. Go Healthy for Good is live every Monday to Thursday at 7 p.m. Eastern Time. Like our Facebook page and follow us on Twitter, Go Healthy Live, and check out our website, hopetv.org/gohealthy. Joining me today is Dr. Joseph Genovese, a board-certified internal medicine physician and a member of the American Gastroenterology Society. He is a gastroenterologist specialist at Capital Digestive Care in Maryland. Welcome, Dr. Genovese.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, now, we're going to talk about digestion today, and I guess if we start right at the front end, we put food in our mouths and we chew. And chewing is the beginning part of digestion. Many people don't realize that because we're mixing the food with saliva. But then we swallow. What happens then?
Well, after we swallow, the esophagus, or swallowing tube, actually pushes the food down into the stomach. It doesn't just fall there. It actually gets pushed by the esophagus. In the stomach, it combines with stomach acid and then gets churned up and mixed up by the stomach and prepared for digestion in the small intestine.
All right, so the stomach, though, acts as a kind of a holding chamber, doesn't it?
Yes,
and
it does.
It's like the largest part of our tubing system there.
You're absolutely right.
Yeah, and then what determines how long food stays in the stomach, and what are the control mechanisms there?
Well, basically, the food, the content of the food, the most important thing is actually the quantity of the food. So in other words, the more you eat, the longer it's going to take for it to empty from your stomach. Also, certain types of food tend to take longer to empty. Foods with a lot of fat in them, for instance, take much longer to empty. Foods with a lot of protein also tend to be churned up in the stomach for a longer period of time before exiting to go into the small bowel to be digested. So basically, again, it's the amount of food and the type of food that determines how long it stays in the stomach.
Now, at the top and the bottom of the stomach, there are sphincters, aren't there?
Yes, there are.
Help with that control. So, mm-hmm. Tell us what those sphincters are.
Well, the one at the very bottom of the esophagus, which separates the esophagus or swallowing tube from the stomach, is called the lower esophageal sphincter. Okay, that actually functions to both let food into the stomach and also keep it there once it's in the stomach. The other sphincter is called the pylorus. It's at the exit of the stomach. The pylorus controls how quickly food leaves. And does also have some, does control the function of the stomach as well in terms of emptying.
Hmm. Now, what happens when things go wrong with the lower esophageal sphincter, which is what we're getting to today? Tell us about this.
Well, what happens when the lower esophageal sphincter is not working properly, basically the most common problem we end up with it is from a lower esophageal sphincter that's too weak. If that's the case, what happens is after the food enters the stomach, if that sphincter muscle is not working well, it may allow food from the stomach to back up into the swallowing tube, where it can cause lots of problems and lots of symptoms.
Now, the acidity in the stomach is pretty high because it produces hydrochloric acid, doesn't it?
That's absolutely correct.
What's the pH of the stomach?
pH of the stomach is generally less than 4.
Whoa, and the pH in the esophagus should be?
Should be higher than 4.
Right.
So basically, again, you don't want acid from the stomach in the esophagus.
Now, what's the difference between the lining of the stomach and the lining of the esophagus? One can take the acid and one can't. What's going on there?
That's correct. Well, basically, the lining of the stomach produces mucus and produces actually bicarbonate that actually protects the lining. There's what's called a mucus layer in the lining of the stomach that protects it. The esophagus is more lined like the inside of the mouth. It doesn't share those kind of protections, and acid in the esophagus can be damaging.
So what are the signs and symptoms that someone would get if they're having GERD, they're getting that acid coming back up into the esophagus?
The most common symptom that people tend to have is what we call heartburn, which is a burning sensation in the chest, sometimes felt in the even as high as the throat or the back of the mouth. Sometimes patients can actually develop a bad taste from this acid coming up as far as the mouth even. Some patients may have other symptoms. Some people will have symptoms simply of bad chest pain. And it can often be mistaken for a heart attack even. So patients may get episodes where they have severe pain and it's really reflux. It's not heart disease at all. The other symptom that some patients may get is more asthmatic symptoms, actually problems with breathing, hoarseness, cough, these sorts of things, particularly at night. So many of these symptoms can result from GERD.
What are the risk factors for GERD? Well, you know, is it habits? Is it running the family? What are the things that
I think most of it really tends to be lifestyle. In other words, patients who are overweight, patients that are overeating, patients that are not eating healthy, many of those patients are set up for reflux and for GERD.
Is there a tendency for it to run in families or not?
Not really. Not so much. I think the problem is it's difficult to know because GERD is so common that it's difficult to sort out whether it's related to the family or whether it's really related to the environment. And I think in this country it's even harder to sort out. But I think there are certain families that may tend to have GERD, and many of those patients, their families may develop at an earlier age. We may see teenagers or young adults that develop GERD.
Right, which is, and it's typically a disease of older age, isn't it?
Correct.
More of retirement age.
Yes.
Than a young person's disease. And if someone leaves it untreated, what are the complications long term?
Well, the one that's most feared is something called Barrett's esophagus. That's a change in the lining of the esophagus, which is considered somewhat precancerous. In other words, people with esophageal cancer sometimes can start out with this Barrett's esophagus. That's the most serious complication we worry about. However, there are patients that develop other problems, such as what we call a stricture or a narrowing of the swallowing tube, where people have trouble swallowing and trouble with food getting down into the stomach because of chronic injury and chronic narrowing of the swallowing tube. So those are the main two things that we worry about. Other things that can happen is actually my dentist colleagues tell me that acid can damage the teeth, and some patients can actually get breakdown of the dental enamel from reflux.
Right. Whew. Well, coming up next, Justin will share a refreshing salad. Don't miss it. We'll be right back.
When Jesus built the church that he calls my church, he gave some special services, blessings, to those who are part of his church. This week on Hope Sabbath School, we'll talk about baptism and foot washing and the communion service. Profound blessings from our Savior to those who are part of his church. We hope you'll join us for Hope Sabbath School.
I know I'm looking for something, but what? Peace? Purpose? Meaning? I'm still not sure, but I know it's going to take faith.
Welcome back. Justin, what have you got today? This looks really yummy.
It really does, most of it. Today,
we'll get to that.
Yeah, we'll get to that. Today, we're making quinoa salad.
And this particular ingredient that's causing you all this turmoil, it should always be present in a salad.
No.
But anyway, tell us what's in it.
Okay, so quinoa salad. I don't know if you've ever heard of quinoa before, but it's this really delicious grain. It's really nutritious too.
It is, and it's spelt like quinoa. So
it's exactly.
It's a very confusing
word
too.
But it's pronounced quinoa.
Yeah.
So quinoa salad, 1 cup uncooked quinoa, We want to make sure to rinse it really well. Half a teaspoon of salt, 2 cups of water, 1/3 cup diced red onion, 2 tablespoons of lime juice, 1 cup of corn kernels, it doesn't matter, canned, frozen, fresh, raw, doesn't matter. 3 medium tomatoes, cut into chunks. That's the part I take issue
with. You almost had indigestion at that. Yes. Carry on.
A 1/4 cup of chopped cilantro, including the stems, and 3 tablespoons of olive oil. So it sounds like a long ingredient list, but it's really easy.
Well, it's. I mean, you look at these and you think, hey, this is another one-pot wonder for me.
Exactly.
Because you've got your grain and your legumes, so you've got all your protein that you
need.
And fiber and everything. Yes, you're right. And there's plenty of protein in both of these. Quinoa is a grain with a lot more protein than your average
grains, like wheat or something.
Right. So you've got some really great ingredients. And I love this with, I love any salad that's got raw straight off the corn cob.
Me too.
But we'll have to go for canned, I guess, at this time of the year.
Yeah.
All right. Okay,
so you're going to boil the quinoa. Boil the quinoa for about 20 minutes until it's nice and soft. And while that's happening...
So that's with the salt and the water.
Right, salt and water.
Yep.
And then...
While that's cooking?
While that's cooking, you're going to just marinate the onions in the...
Someone like you wouldn't probably think that you need to marinate onions, but
someone like me... Being that I'm a bachelor?
That you just eat onions like apples.
Okay, that's right. No marinade needed. That's right.
But it takes that lime juice, will just take that nice, the edge off. So make it a little nicer
the edge,
for the rest
the edge
of it.
Is what
you
it's
want
all about.
The edge.
Yeah.
You live on the edge.
That's right. Okay, so with that done, we just combine it all in a bowl. I'm going to start with the quinoa because quinoa is just so cool.
It is.
Yeah.
It's such a light, it makes a lovely light salad. I often find with a pasta salad, I feel a bit heavy at the end, but quinoa, I always feel nice and light.
And it's got such a nice flavor too.
Yeah.
And it's shaped really cool. It's got a little spiral thing that comes off of
Those
it.
Are arms and legs, not spiral.
Okay. In fact, there's actually a great all vegan plant-based restaurant in Fort Worth, Texas.
Really? It
takes its name from quinoa.
In Texas? You mean a vegan restaurant could survive in
cattle country, Fort Worth, Texas. There's a place called Spiral Diner.
Really? And they use quinoa because the spiral.
Yeah, that's where they got. I'm going to add these tomatoes in, but under duress.
Well, you can only put half if you want.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'll put like a quarter. I'll put one piece of tomato in there. And give you that piece. Some black beans. My favorite bean.
Really?
By far.
Well, I think if you come from Texas, black beans would have to be your favorite, would they not?
I would think so, yeah. They're just so delicious.
They are.
Add some corn in there.
They really are.
And when it's corn season, there is never a moment in which my kitchen does not have raw, you know, ears of corn in it, ready for boiling.
Oh, in our kitchen, they're just ready for eating.
Yeah.
We don't boil. We skip that step.
Kind of like me and the onions?
Yeah. You like you and the onions.
That's right.
But to me, they taste very similar, raw or...
Yeah, that's true. And I don't cook mine very long. You really only need to blanch them for like a minute. And
that's right.
Got some cilantro in there.
And cilantro, my favorite herb.
Yes. A little bit of oil.
Now, I think probably you'd want to salt this to taste, right?
Yeah, you would. Yeah. You would want to add a little bit of salt.
Mm. Oh, that's looking so beautiful.
Isn't that wonderful?
Oh, yeah.
It's got all the different colors in there.
It does. And all the colors means all the different phytochemicals are colored. Mm-hmm. Now, someone who might have GERD might want to use low acidity tomatoes.
Such a thing exists.
Oh, yes. Roma. Okay. Roma tomatoes are actually.
Oh, really?
They are. But, Well, I'll stand here like Oliver and say, more, please.
Okay. I just find it so fascinating that the colors of raw food indicate the kind of phytonutrients that you have. So if you want the whole spectrum of phytonutrients, you get the whole spectrum of colors.
The rainbow.
It's just fascinating.
It is. It is, yeah.
It's because it's not food coloring that makes raw food the color. It's the nutrients that give it the color.
Right. I see what you mean. Yeah. It's wonderful. Well, here we go.
I'm going to try to fish out a piece with no tomato in it.
I'll try and get a piece without onion.
Okay. Ding.
Ding.
It's just lovely, isn't it?
Mm. Mm.
Cilantro, the
onion. Oh, yeah. Those flavors are just gorgeous.
Mm-hmm.
Now let's watch a video from Mount Sinai Hospital where the director of endoscopy shares information on persistent reflux.
The question to ask yourself is, am I having symptoms of reflux frequently and have those persisted for a long period of time? So if you or someone you know has frequent heartburn or regurgitation sensation or even chronic cough over a long period of time, or you're continually using over-the-counter medications to treat your acid reflux, then one should consider talking to a primary care physician or an internist. For patients who may not have a primary care physician or an internist, one can go to a center that specializes in esophageal disorders or reflux disease, or consider speaking to a gastroenterologist as well. Your doctor may prescribe a course of medication, an acid-blocking medication, to treat those symptoms. For patients who respond to those medications, typically, that may be all that is required, but if the symptoms persist or if you fail to respond to medications, your doctor may recommend evaluation by a gastroenterologist and possibly an upper endoscopy to look at the esophagus for Barrett's esophagus or even damage to the esophagus, what is called esophagitis. If you do have Barrett's esophagus, be reassured that most patients with Barrett's esophagus never go on to develop esophageal cancer. The risk of developing esophageal cancer in Barrett's esophagus is roughly about 0.5 to 1% per year. And if you do have Barrett's esophagus, you can be surveyed by upper endoscopy on typically an every 3-year basis. If you do have Barrett's with dysplasia, what is known as precancer, or if you do have esophageal cancer, then you should definitely consider seeking evaluation in a referral center that specializes in Barrett's esophagus and esophageal cancer. These are the centers that are most likely to have the surgeons with the greatest volume, expertise, and the best surgical options. And these are the centers that are also most likely to offer a full armamentarium of endoscopic technologies and therapies such as confocal microendoscopy, radiofrequency ablation, and endoscopic mucosal resection.
There's so much. Well, joining us now is Dr. Adia Regania, Walgreens registered pharmacist. Welcome to Go Healthy for Good, Dr. Adia.
Thanks for having me.
Now, before the break, we were just talking about GERD. Now, we didn't cover something called hiatus hernia. Can you explain to us about hiatus hernia?
Sure. Hiatus hernia is basically a hernia in the diaphragm, a muscle that sits inside the belly cavity and controls breathing. Now, the hiatal hernia, if you have that, many people have heard of hiatal hernia, and in fact, many people think of that interchangeably with GERD. It is true that if there is...
And I think we've got a picture up that shows how the stomach is coming up above the diaphragm.
Exactly. But, yep. What ends up happening is the stomach does, part of it ends up above the diaphragm in the chest, and that part of the stomach actually, it's very prone to reflux. In other words, what's in that area very easily moves up into the swallowing tube and causes problems. Now, it is true that many people that have hiatal hernias have GERD, but there are many patients with GERD who do not have hiatal hernia, so they're not the same thing. But a hiatal hernia certainly can contribute to the problem.
So it would put someone more at risk.
More at risk, absolutely.
It's a clear risk factor for it. Now, Dr. Regani, are there any medications that would actually predispose someone to GERD?
Yes, there are several of them. One of the most common one is NSAID, which is non-steroidal anti-inflammatory, and they're all over-the-counter. People go take them without questioning the pharmacist.
So like ibuprofen,
Aleve, which is naproxen sodium, aspirin. These are all causes.
Any other groups, classes of drugs?
There are many different ones. Narcotics causes, and there are some blood pressure medications like calcium channel blockers. They cause GERD. So we recommend the patient, if they have that problem already, to should talk to their primary doctor about it so they can have a better choice of medication for them.
Right, so they may just need some adjustment in those medications. Now, we saw a quick video there, but tell us, how do you diagnose GERD?
GERD is basically what we call clinical diagnosis. It means that the patient has the proper symptoms in the right clinical setting. If the story makes sense, we diagnose GERD. And it's basically based on the symptoms that we talked about, either heartburn, chest pain, or asthmatic symptoms that seem to be related to meals. So that's one way to diagnose it. There are more sort of fancier exams that can be done, what's called a 24-hour pH study, for instance. These aren't used commonly because, again, it's very easy to clinically diagnose GERD. The real question ends up being is it causing any damage? Is there Barrett's? And that's where endoscopy comes in, and that's where endoscopy is very helpful.
So it would be sustained, persistent reflux, then you might use these.
You might use that to make sure that to sort of assess how much damage is going on and whether this Barrett's esophagus they talked about in the last segment might be present.
All right. Now, moving on to treatment, let's start with you, Dr. Reggani. You've got a nice array of things here. What might someone be able to buy over the counter here in America to treat, and what might they start with and then move up to?
Sure. The first recommendation is always come to the pharmacist and ask questions, because GERD can be mistaken with other problems, so we have to make sure what they have is GERD. Mm. There are a lot of time people have a problem with acid reflux, like one of them is pregnancy, because their condition is changing, so they push on the stomach and it causes that. That doesn't mean necessarily they have GERD.
Right.
So when they come to us first, we, as a pharmacist, we always go ask questions collectively to see why they think they have acid reflux problem.
Mm-hmm.
As you see, we have different products here.
Sure.
That I brought.
These would be what they typically
start with? I put
them
in different categories. Mm. These are all called antacids. That means they neutralizes the acid. It
all
works
right.
Afterward. So when you have an acid reflux problem, you come to me and I say, my stomach is sour, I need something, that this is works right
so,
away.
So the antacid would work straight away and it,
exactly.
combat, it sort of counteracts the acid.
Exactly, but that's not a solution. This is just a quick fix. But if they have a problem for acid reflux more than 2-3 weeks in a row and it's happening 3-4 times a week, then they have a problem. They have a serious problem. That should not be the solution for them because of a lot of side effects they have.
Mm-hmm.
They cause constipation, some of them, depend upon what they are.
Sure.
They cause diarrhea. So we don't want them to stay on those if they have a GERD problem.
Mm-hmm.
Then we go to this category here, which are H2 antagonists. These are antihistamine. Which is responsible for the acid. It controls the acid. Then again, patient goes to the counter to buy this because what they see in the advertising, they just go and take it. It doesn't work that way. They have to make sure how it works and when to take it.
And so what dose to take.
Also. Exactly.
Yeah.
So, and if they are qualified for it or not. So if they are, it has to be taken 2 hours, half an hour to 1 hour before meal. How it works, it has to get to the bloodstream and stop the release of acid. So when they eat, it would work for them, yes.
Sure.
That it has to be done before it's happening, not after.
All right.
And then,
so this counteracts the acid, but that turns down acid production.
Correct.
All right. Well, thank you. We'll come to the last class in a minute. But what lifestyle factors, Dr. Genovese, might people need to adjust? You mentioned that in the first segment.
Right. I think the most important thing that I find that that seems to help my patients is making sure for their evening meal, which in America is traditionally the largest meal, make sure that they're not laying down or going to sleep for at least 3 hours after that evening meal. So that's probably the most important lifestyle change. I counsel my patients, if they have problems with GERD, to try to spread their calories out more, eat a little bit more at lunch and maybe a little bit less at dinner, and avoid the bedtime snack. That's the real no-no.
Right. So how long would it take for the large meal in the evening to actually empty completely from the stomach and the stomach be ready to itself to go to sleep?
Well, basically, you're talking 2 or 3 hours. I mean, absolutely. It takes a while.
Because I understood it took 4.5 hours mm-hmm. to really for the stomach mm-hmm. to empty properly.
I think that's about right.
Yeah. On x-ray studies, when they put some contrast in a meal, mm-hmm. you can actually see when the last of it leaves. And yes, you're right, 3 hours, it's a large part of it is gone. But mm-hmm. for someone who with GERD, they might want to play it a little bit safer even still.
I have to agree.
Now, also, smoking, alcohol, any of those
habits
implicated here?
Yeah, I mean, certainly being over your ideal body weight is a real risk factor. So again, it's another reason if you're overweight to lose weight to help GERD symptoms. Smoking also can really make things worse. The nicotine has effects on the esophagus as well as acid production. So that's very important. Mm. So those are the two main ones. Certainly pregnancy is a risk, but again, part of that is having to be more careful during the pregnancy. Many of those problems will go away afterwards.
Yes, so that's only a 9-month problem.
Yeah, a temporary problem, yes.
And that's because of the hormones as well as the increasing pressure mm-hmm. in the abdomen. Now, increasing pressure in the abdomen makes me think of perhaps tight clothing, breathing incorrectly. Those things must predispose, just like the pregnancy does.
I think so. Again, certainly, again, people are overweight, tend to wear their clothing a little bit more tightly as well. But again, even someone who's thin, if they wear their clothing too tightly, it can actually push on the abdominal wall and push food from the stomach up into the swallowing tube. Absolutely.
Right. And when we looked at those hiatus hernia pictures, you could just imagine that with a tight belt. Now, let's come back to this last class of drugs you were talking about over here. Tell us about these, Dr. Regani.
These are PPI, which are prothrombin inhibitors. They also work a similar way as these. It has to be taken 30 minutes to 1 hour before food, so it gets to the bloodstream and stop the release, pumping the acid in the stomach. So those are almost, you know, they're same category. Both the one you just put down, Prevacid, that was a prescription item, just came over the counter. Mm-hmm. But even though they're accessible, I still advise people to go to the pharmacist and ask for advice before just go take them. Mm. There are a lot of things. A lot of times they come to us more before they go to the doctor, so we can help them out a little bit and advise them. If it doesn't help them in 2 weeks in a row, then they should go see a doctor for sure.
How long can people take all these various medications?
Well, if they do it themselves, they medicating themselves, I would not recommend it more than 2 weeks.
Right.
But if doctors can prescribe them and they can be on them for years, mm-hmm. but under supervision of a doctor, that's very important.
All right. What would you be worried about long term with these medications?
The main concerns that have come up, there's been several concerns raised, but the main ones that that we seem to be concerned about is mostly calcium and magnesium malabsorption. Now, calcium malabsorption is important because it can lead to thinning of the bones and premature osteoporosis, so it's a very important thing to be aware of. Mm. I have my patients generally, I ask them to take a calcium supplement. I also ask them to have their primary doctors as part of their regular physicals to periodically obtain bone density determinations, what's called a DEXA scan, in patients that are on these medications. Mm-hmm. Also, any patient who can be controlled without the medications, we try to do that as well. So if there are patients that are really willing to completely modify their lifestyle and their diet, many of those patients may be able to do well without the medication. And that's, for me, that's one of my goals.
So you might use this as a bridge while they make those lifestyle changes, get the benefit from them, then you can wean them off the medication. That makes so much sense. Well, coming up next, it's time to exercise. Sean's already warming up, I can see him, so get ready. First, though, let's take a look at today's medical news report. In the headlines today, daily habits erode esophagus, breathe through esophagitis and bedhead up. Two research groups based in Japan looked at lifestyle factors associated with reflux disease and esophagitis. They found a number of culprits, including inadequate sleep, severe stress, lack of physical exercise, being overweight, eating a large supper, having a midnight snack, skipping breakfast, eating too quickly, eating eggs, taking non-steroidal drugs or antihypertensive drugs, smoking and drinking alcohol. Now that gives you plenty to work on to prevent or treat reflux disease. When the lower esophageal sphincter malfunctions, stomach acid may enter the esophagus, causing reflux disease. Since the sphincter is surrounded by muscles of the diaphragm, an Austrian group did a study teaching patients to engage the diaphragm to aid the lower esophageal sphincter. They randomized patients to active breathing training or to routine treatment for reflux. Those using breathing training had a significant improvement in quality of life, less acidity in the esophagus, and a significant decrease in their need for medication. Now that sounds like a good alternative to drugs and surgery. Heartburn and gastroesophageal reflux symptoms are often worse at night while lying down. Elevation of the head of the bed is thought to alleviate these symptoms. A study published in the Journal of Gastroenterology and Hepatology explored the impact that sleeping with 8 inches elevation of the head of the bed would have on reflux disease. They found that reflux time and frequency, acid clearance symptoms, and sleep disturbances were all improved with this simple intervention. So if you've not tried it yet, you might consider 8-inch blocks under the head of your bed. I'm Dr. Narita McKibben, and that's today's Medical News Report.
The Lord is my rock, my fortress and my deliverer. My God is my rock, in whom I take refuge. He is my shield and the horn of my salvation, my stronghold.
As for me, I call to God and the Lord saves me. Evening, morning, and noon I cry out in distress, and He hears my voice.
Welcome back to Go Healthy for Good. Sean, what have you got in store for us today?
Some bodyweight exercises. I got some dumbbells over here just in case.
Yeah.
So we'll
just see. In case I need more weight.
Just in case.
Okay.
All right. So we're going to start with getting warmed up. Let's start with some jumping jacks. All right. We're going to do a very quick workout. So what you can do, a lot of folks don't have a lot of time. What you can do is set a kitchen timer for about 6 minutes. And I'm going to give you a couple exercises that you can keep on repeating for that 6 minutes, especially if you're limited for time. All right. So let's start with some jumping jacks. All right. Everything for today, we'll just do 5. But if you're doing this for the workout, do about 10 to 20. All right. So let's do 5 in 3, 2, 1, go. 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5. All right? Get your body going. All right?
Mm-hmm.
What we're going to start with are inchworms. All right? Stand
all right.
up tall. All right? Hands down. All right? And go all the way out. All right? As if you're going to do a push-up. Make sure the hips come down. All right? You do not have to do a push-up. And then,
I am so glad.
I won't touch you today. And then back up. All right? You will feel a stretch in your hamstring. All right, but what I want you to do at the top of that inchworm is to do a lunge here and then a lunge on the opposite leg. Okay, then go back into your inchworm. All right, So this is a nice compound exercise, working the core, working your scapula area. Go back up, get the stretch in the hamstring, come up and lunge. Right leg and left leg. All right, one more time. All the way down. I'm going to do the push-up. Dr. Narendra is off the hook today. And
that's
up.
Very unusual for me to be off the hook.
And then the lunge. Right. You can do about 5 of these where each inchworm and a lunge on both is considered one rep. All right.
Okay.
Then go back into your jumping jack. Let's do 5 jumping jacks in 3, 2, and 1. Go. 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5. All right. So what I have here are some dumbbells. You can use the dumbbells since you didn't do the push-up. You could hold it right here. All right. What we're going to do is a squat. All right. Pay close attention. Squat. And then the weight here, we're going to open out. All right. Perfect. So squat again. All right. You can use a can of beans. You can use whatever you want. Back down. You could do about 10 reps where you squat down, working the back of the arm, working your rear delts. Back down. Let's do one more after these. All the way out. Last one. And Doc, drop the weight. All right. Drop it. All perfect. Right. 5 jumping jacks in 3, 2, and 1. Go. 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5. All right. So you got some compound exercises, and then in between each exercise, you're adding in a cardiovascular exercise. So what I want you to do is take that timer, stick it for 6 minutes, 5 minutes, 4 minutes, whatever it is, and you go nonstop throughout that workout.
And just repeating it.
Just repeat it. Now, you have limited time. You want to do is minimize the rest just to keep that heart working a little bit. And we talked about a couple episodes before that exercise post-oxygen consumption where you're burning so much calories after you work out. And that's what you want. You want to be able to hit the workout hard for a few minutes and then the body just keep on going.
Right. And you know, it's great even in the office to do some exercise at the top of the hour for 5 minutes. And then you're going to keep burning for the next part of that hour.
Absolutely.
And then it's time to do another short burst of exercise.
And we were talking about small foods. You know, you burn it off, and it's a great way to kind of keep that body going.
Yeah, I like it.
Yeah.
So do we have to stretch at all?
We do. Let's go.
We do. Okay.
So nice wide base. All right, take a deep breath and go down. Now, we did work our hamstrings a little bit. Mm. Now, we only did a couple reps, right? I didn't torture you enough.
No, you didn't torture me very much today.
So what I want you to do is go forward out. Okay? And what we're going to do is put our legs together and alternate your right hand on the outside of your, I mean your right leg on the outside of your right arm, right here, okay? Just to get a nice stretch in that hamstring area, and then back, switch sides, okay? One more time, right, and then the left. And what I want you to do is put your feet together, bring your hips down, stretch that lower back a little bit, all the way back up. I know that's a yoga move. I forgot the name of it. Is it the downward dog?
Something. Not sure.
I won't call you funny names. I promise.
No, you don't call me downward dog, but you will have me doing hydrant.
There it is. That's Chad's favorite move. So let's open and close. You know, Chad still talks about that. Open and close.
Yeah, he sure enjoyed that workout a couple of weeks ago. Oh, sorry.
No problem. So what this is doing is stretching out your back, that scapular area that we worked with the squat here.
All right.
And at the same time, stretching out your chest cavity. All right. Mm-hmm. If you did the push-ups, this is a great way to open up that chest cavity, stretch out that pectoral muscle, and just relax.
How you feel? It all, doesn't it?
How you feel?
Good. Yeah, energized.
You know, you got limited time, you might as well make the best of it.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, that's great. Thank you.
You're very welcome.
Well, in just a moment, I'm going to answer some of your questions. You, our faithful viewers that have sent me during our previous shows, I'm looking forward to it. But first, let's enjoy another Ageless Advantage spot.
Are midnight raids on the refrigerator spoiling your healthy eating plans? 3 recent studies found a delicious way to control your hunger cravings: eating more whole grains. The studies all showed that people who eat more whole grains actually eat less because they feel fuller with less food. Regularly enjoying oatmeal, quinoa, and other whole grains will make you feel full more quickly, and it will keep the hunger pangs away. Adding whole grains to your daily diet is another ageless advantage.
Now, we have a great offer. If you call now and ask us a question about gastroesophageal esophageal reflux disease during a live broadcast, we'll send you this book free. So call us now, 855-400-HEALTHY. That's 855-400-4325. Or if you're calling from overseas or texting your question, the number's 301-960-5144. Or you can Facebook your question while we're live. The free book offer is restricted to viewers of our live show here in America. Now, if you missed a previous episode or you want to download one of our recipes, then visit our website, hopetv.org/gohealthy. We're also on iTunes, so look there for our video podcast. Well, I want to thank you for your comments and your questions on Facebook, and here are some right now. Yotka posted on Facebook, Dr. Nerida, thank you for the great show. I learned a lot about dental care. That's great, Yotka. So did I. It was very good. Our guests were great, weren't they? Wendy posted on Facebook, I'm from Honduras. I live in the Bay Island. And I'm going to try that turkey. Oh, I love the Bay Island area of Honduras. It's just beautiful. And good for you, trying turkey. Thank you for the delicious recipes. I'm just starting my vegetarian life, and I'm so happy you give all these options in food and show that being a vegetarian is so much healthier and better. Thank you for your programs. Bless you, Wendy. Now, we had a caller that said, what causes tingling and numbness in the feet? Well, the first thing that I would be concerned about would be some kind of nerve problem. And if it's related, if you have diabetes, I'd be quite concerned that the diabetes is damaging the nerves in your feet. It could also be poor circulation in the feet, so some circulatory problem. I would definitely be seeing my doctor if I had tingling and numbness of the feet, because you also need to think about other things, more serious things too, like multiple sclerosis and those kind of things. So get that checked out. Donna asked, what can I do to prevent bad halitosis? Well, if you don't know what halitosis is, it's bad breath. So Donna, what I would say is after last week's show, we talked about dental hygiene. You might go back and review that show and just be sure that there's no gum disease or dental hygiene issues that you just need to attend to. Might be post-nasal drip. Could be that you're just eating lots of garlic and onions, in which case have some parsley with them. Some people have bad halitosis if their whole gastrointestinal system is slowed down and they have constipation. That can actually cause bad breath also. You might want to think about doing some gastrointestinal cleanse and just see if that problem goes away. But you could see your doctor and just have a few of those things checked out if you think that you've not got control of that. So you don't have to have bad halitosis. You can get on top of it. Well, thanks for sending your questions. Keep them coming. If you have a question on gastroesophageal reflux disease, our number is 855-400-HEALTHY. That's 855-400-4325. Now, Kim Quinlan will share with us her story on persistent reflux. Take a look at this.
Kim Quinlan is about to have minimally invasive surgery to cure her acid reflux.
It hurts. It's sore. It's like having a sore throat, strep throat a lot. I have a hard time working out. I mean, doing anything physical if there's food in my stomach, even liquids, because the pressure seems to want to back it back up my throat.
Medication and diet changes can help manage GERD, but not for Kim, which is why the 39-year-old nurse searched the internet for a cure and came up with Lynx, a new FDA-approved device that uses a flexible band of magnets enclosed in titanium beads.
The idea behind it is to implant a magnetic ring around the esophagus to augment the sphincter, to make that reflux barrier stronger so that it will not readily open and allow acid reflux disease to happen.
Surgery takes about an hour, and unlike other GERD surgery, which is not reversible and can leave a patient unable to belch or vomit, the new Lynx system is flexible and removable if necessary.
The device is set up such that when you have the magnets implanted, they have a certain burst pressure. As the stomach distends and the body wants to vomit, the stomach will produce an excessive amount of pressure, but the magnet will open up, give way, and everything will come out. It gives patients an alternative to what we have done standard for the last 25 years.
Recovery for Kim will take about 2 weeks. Doctors say she's doing well. In Seattle, this is Mark Christopher.
Wow, these fascinating new things, they're quite amazing. Have you come across this new magnet treatment yet?
This is hot off the press. This is really new.
Yeah. it looks pretty non-invasive once. It looks like they're doing it by keyhole surgery.
Yes.
So just a few, what, three or four little cuts in the abdomen mm-hmm. and pop it in place. And it's pretty neat that it's a dynamic system.
Yes, I agree. It's not the fixed system that you have with the old hiatal hernia repairs.
Right. Yeah. Well, it'll be interesting to see if it takes off. Yeah. We can you can watch that space for us.
I will.
Now, I think we're getting some questions already by text message. So here is one. What changes can be made to help with your stomach having a sour taste and coming up in your throat? I eat 4 to 5 hours before I go to bed and I take Nexium. So what would you say to this caller? They've clearly got some reflux going on there.
It sounds like the Nexium may not be doing enough. I'd be curious as to when they're taking the Nexium. I often, with my patients that have nighttime symptoms, if it's more of that, I tend to have them take the Nexium before dinner, about a half an hour before dinner, to hopefully block acid for that dinner time and over the night.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for that. Now, here's another message. What is the best way to wean off Prilosec? Is it okay to take PPIs every other day or alternate with histamine blockers if this controls symptoms? So, Dr. Regani, how would you get someone off of the Prilosec?
We have to see what the problem is and why they are on it for that long. If they are under doctor's supervision, they have to go with the doctor's recommendation.
All right.
If they do it by themselves, they're self-medicating, that's a different story.
Yeah.
So they can do alternating, and as doctor just mentioned, they can is the time that they take their medicine is very important.
Mm.
Nexium and all the PPIs are once a day dosing, so they have to look to see what part of a day they have more reflux, and which meal is the biggest. So then they can change that time of taking the medicine. For instance, if they get more heartburn at nighttime, they should take it half an hour before their dinner. If there is a during the day, they should take it half an hour before their breakfast, so it would last them all day. So it all depends on each person. It has to be individualized.
So how would you take someone off if they were under your care?
Well, basically, the most important thing is to make sure you have a supply of antacids to take care of the symptoms in the meantime. One thing we know happens with the PPIs is that when you stop them, the stomach may actually make more acid than it was before.
So it may actually kind of a rebound for a while.
What we call a rebound, exactly. And to get around that, it takes about 2 or 3 weeks for that to go away, for that rebound effect to go away. So basically, you want to make sure, number one, that you have a lot of antacids to help with that. Number two, you can do it either way. Some patients take a lot of antacids and just stop the PPIs cold turkey, as it were. Other patients may take it every other day, then every third day, and then every fourth day, and taper it over a 2 or 3 week period of time.
Mm-hmm.
But again, as I said, the important thing is to make sure you have some antacids on board to be able to, on hand, so you can take care of the acute problems that arise.
Excellent. I am pregnant and have terrible heartburn. What should I do?
Well, for pregnancy, the safest thing that we can always prescribe is Tums. It has calcium, so especially if they're not taking enough milk, it would substitute that calcium for them, and it's harmless, so they can go ahead.
So Tums might be a really good thing in that it's going to be a nice, safe antacid and give them the extra calcium at the same time.
Exactly. And what you said at the beginning, lifestyle, it's very important. You can't fix everything with medication. If they control their portion of their food, what they eat, and eliminate the thing that it causes the GERD, then this would be their rescue.
Well, in this case, it's
pregnancy. Yeah, this is the last rescue.
Yes. Now, it seems that my husband has heartburn every night. I think he should see a doctor. He thinks he should just continue taking antacids. Who's right? Dr. Genovese,
I have to say the wife is right in this case. He should be seeing a doctor because you can't really tell how much damage is going on without a thorough evaluation by your doctor.
Mm. And if it's going on months?
Yeah, I mean, if it's months at a time, I mean, we talked about 2 weeks, and I think that's a good rule of thumb. If you're having persistent symptoms of more than twice a week for more than 2 or 3 weeks, you ought to really be seeing a doctor about it.
Mm. All right, that sounds like very good advice. Here's one. My 9-year-old constantly complains of heartburn, is it okay to give him an antacid about three to five times a week?
I think, again, especially with the kids, it's important that a doctor supervise this. It doesn't sound like it's outlandish for the amount of antacid she's talking about, but still, if you're using it 3 to 5 times a week, a doctor ought to be seeing that child.
Hmm. What might be going on?
Well, it could be gastroesophageal reflux disease. I mean, there's no question the kids can get it as well. But it's, you want to really tease out the symptoms to really understand what's going on. And again, I'm not sure that you can tell, unless your physician talking with a child, what exactly might be going on.
All right. Well, thank you. We now have a caller on the line, Margaret from New Orleans. Margaret, welcome to Go Healthy for Good. What's your question for my guests this evening?
My question is that, can these over-the-counter medications cure acid reflux? Or do I have to take or further treatment is advised?
All right.
Well, I think the thing I have to say is these medications do not cure reflux. They do prevent complications of reflux, some of the things we talked about, and they're very useful in that way. But again, they don't cure the disease. Mostly what ends up happening, I think, is for most patients, if they're able to really make big lifestyle change, they can effectively cure the disease. Though, again, these drugs certainly don't cure it.
So the drugs are more to treat the symptoms?
To treat the symptoms and also prevent possible complications.
Exactly. Complications and worsening of the problem.
Exactly.
And the lifestyle change will be actually what cures the problem.
All right. Exactly.
All right. Now we have another caller on the line, Marguerite from Florida. Marguerite, welcome to Go Healthy. What's your question for my experts this evening?
My question is, I'm a patient with the acid reflux problem. And I was on the Nexium for a while, then I read on somewhere that papaya can help with it. And for the past 6 months, I've been taking papaya before I eat. And I got to wean myself from the Nexium. My question is, do you think there is a relation between the papaya and the reflux that can help me not having to take the Nexium?
Well, good question. Papaya and reflux disease. Do either of you know the answer to this question?
I can only surmise that maybe the papaya itself is having some digestive effect on the food, allowing for the food to leave the stomach more quickly and perhaps preventing reflux in that way. But again, I'd like to see a scientific study to prove that. That would be a great research project.
Yes, it would, because papaya and I think pineapple, too, they both have digestive enzymes in them. It would be great to see if that could actually impact digestive issues. Great question, Marguerite. Thank you. Here is another question. Oh, you know, we didn't really cover the topic of surgery, so I'm going to sneak my own question in here.
Okay.
What about surgery for gastroesophageal? If we've tried the whole lifestyle and the medications are just continually ongoing, does surgery have a place?
I think surgery has a role. I use surgery or recommend surgery in my patients where the medications aren't working, if they're on high doses of them, if they're really having difficulties or complications. Fortunately, this is a very, very small subset of patients. I think surgery can be the answer for some patients. It really requires a thorough evaluation because, again, as we know, there are multiple factors that contribute to reflux. If stomach emptying is a big problem, the surgery has to be modified or adjusted for that factor. So what's really important when you're considering surgery is to have a thorough evaluation of really what is causing the reflux.
All right. Now, here's a Facebook question. Jerry has posted, does drinking with meals increase reflux? So filling your stomach with the food as well as fluid, does that increase in volume predispose to reflux?
I think volume definitely has a role. I wasn't sure whether he meant maybe alcoholic drinking.
No, I think just fluids, yes. So you think...
Yeah, I would think, again, it's the total volume of the meal that's important.
So maybe stop drinking fluids about half an hour before meals and allow about an hour and a half for that meal to be processed, digested, mixed with those digestive juices before you then throw in a whole glass of water.
That makes sense to me.
All right. Great question, Jerry. Now, we've got so many questions coming in. What should I do, Dr. Rugani? What should I do if I take an antacid after every meal?
That is the problem.
It's a problem?
That's a problem. Right. That's a problem. They have to go see a doctor for sure.
Okay.
If that means it's happening three times a day?
Yes.
That's
it,
a lot.
It looks like it from their question.
They have to see a doctor for sure.
All right. And here's another one for you. What is the best over-the-counter medication for acid reflux?
As we said before, we have to see how many times a week they're getting it, and if they are changing their lifestyle and they're still getting that, so then we have to go with the variety of these that we have. The PPI is good for people who get in more often than others. For once in a while people, we just say regular antacid. It should be fine.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, what foods should people avoid? What foods would help this problem? Any foods that help?
Yes, I mean, I think the problem is the foods that you have to avoid are all things that everyone loves.
Like?
It's a problem. You know, primarily fatty foods. Right. So basically, you know, reducing the amount of fat in your diet, reducing the amount of meat, I think, is going to be helpful. We know that citrus itself in an inflamed esophagus is going to make things worse. So anything that's acidic of fruits and so forth can be a problem. Tomato sauce is a big one, and as an Italian, it's a problem for someone like me who likes to eat a lot of pasta and likes tomato sauce.
Oh, well, that's great advice. Well, I want to thank you, Dr. Rigani. Thank you, Dr. Genovese. That hour flew by. Gastroesophageal reflux disease can be persistent and pervasive. Today, we've learned that there are many triggers, and most of them within your control. So before you resort to the prescriptions or surgery, you owe it to yourself to adjust your lifestyle. Lose weight, loosen those tight waistbands, eliminate alcohol and caffeine, quit smoking, review your medications, and if necessary, consider a change. Avoid acidic, spicy, or high-fat foods. Eat a hearty breakfast and a light supper. Don't snack during the day and don't overeat. Instead, allow at least 4 hours between meals for your stomach to empty and take a rest. Don't eat anything within 4 hours of bedtime, not even a peanut. And actively manage your stress levels by being active. In fact, a gentle walk after meals will aid digestion. Thanks for joining us and go healthy for good. We'll see you next time.